It is Saturday, July 5th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP, Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Good morning and welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair this morning, and with me in the studio is Lindsay Lonnie. She's a systems analyst and web programmer. Hi, Lindsay.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. It's just you and me today.
Woohoo.
That means we can talk about whatever we want.
All right.
We kind of do anyway.
Right.
Right. But now it feels like we can just like put all our elbows on the whole countertop and talk about whatever we want to talk about.
I know. I've got the center mic now.
Yeah, it's kind of exciting. We can have like direct line of sight. And lots to talk about, particularly in the political realm today.
Yeah, a lot of fun stuff going on. Have you heard of the May Day Super PAC?
Yes. I would see headlines throughout the week referring to the May Day PAC, and I'm not up on all the details, but it sounds like you might be.
Yeah, well, July 4th yesterday was a big milestone for them. So one of the things that happened a couple weeks ago is that Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple Computer, along with other tech industry bigwigs, they came out to endorse Lawrence Lessig's May Day Political Action Committee. Mm-hmm. It's at mayday.us.
Okay. And Lessig was Electronic Frontier Foundation. He founded the whole concept of a Creative Commons, didn't he?
That was one of his things, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So he's also, you know, academic and into politics. And
he's from Harvard.
Yes.
Okay. So mayday.us. And what's that all about?
Well, the basic idea is that government is heavily influenced by PACs and super PACs, mm-hmm. and that those don't always represent the public interest. They have their own interests. Usually they're funded by corporations, private funders, things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So the concept is, why not have a PAC that supports fundamental reform, like campaign finance, things like that? And so the ultimate goal is getting government out of the hands of big money, big business, and back into the hands of the people. And in May, they set a goal of collecting $1 million in crowdfunding, $1 million.
Okay.
And they met that within 2 weeks. And
not bad.
They had other people who matched that. So they had $2 million. And then the more recent thing is between June 4th and the 4th of July, yesterday, they were trying to get another $5 million, which would also be matched. And as of the middle of this past week, they weren't really very close to getting the goal.
It was like a $2 million something, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And but they did meet and surpass that goal as of yesterday. I checked the website.
You know, I just looked at it this morning, and they're at 5,196,000 or something like that.
Woohoo!
Which may have changed by the time I looked at it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's changing constantly.
Yeah.
So they currently have $12 million.
Okay.
To reach these goals, and then what they're hoping to do is put that money towards reviewing candidates from both parties and decide who will be five candidates that they support in the 2015 election races.
How will they know that they're candidates they want to support?
These will be candidates that have vowed to support election reform, that support their cause of getting big business and big money out of running the
show. So this reminds me a little bit of the concept behind a land trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
If developers and big money buy up the land to develop it, then perhaps the thing to do is to start a land trust so that these nonprofit entities can buy up the land to keep it open.
Right. Exactly.
So when money is what talks in politics, let's get some money into politics.
Right. Fight money with money.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So hopefully they'll win their 2015 election races, and then the team will use what they learned in 2015 to run an even larger campaign in 2016. And they want to win more seats and have more influence at that point.
Okay. So they're looking at strategic districts for the coming election mm-hmm. to see if this concept actually plays out well.
Right.
If they select candidates, do those candidates wind up supporting the causes that they're hoping they will support or pushing for legislation in the areas that they hope to have legislation pushed.
Exactly, yeah.
And with the right point of view.
Right.
You know, or the point of view they have in mind, I should say.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of X factors, but, you know, it's a great concept and a lot of people are excited about it.
Yeah.
It's gotten attention from people in the tech industry because a lot of tech industry people are pro-reform. You know, there's some people that are not into reform, but most people, at least that I'm aware of in my industry, are into reform for these laws.
Yeah. And that's a distinction that Lessig was making, that this is not money to support tech industry concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Reform concerns is what they're after.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Even though Steve Wozniak got involved, they originally put up
just
a page
last week, right?
That appealed to the tech community.
Yeah.
I think a week before last. And I can't find that page now.
Huh.
So I don't know if they, you know, figured that didn't fit with their message and so they took it down, or if I just couldn't find it when I was looking for it.
Yeah.
But their main page is up and they still have the videos up from Steve Wozniak, and they've also got people supporting them like Union Square Ventures, Fred Wilson, PayPal co-founder, Peter Thiel, LinkedIn co-founder, Reid Hoffman,
mm-hmm.
and then a bunch of venture capitalists are doing some of the funding, like Brad Burnham and the Wilsons, Andersons, and the guy that does the TED conferences, stuff like that.
Chris, what's his name?
Chris Anderson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's interesting because there is a lot of crossover. Like, I think crowdfunding is so successful because people who are feeling facile with tech and the interweb are likely to click on, yeah, here's money.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so the trick will be, can the message go beyond that sort of low-hanging fruit?
Right.
And get to other people who feel that reform is important but may not be as tech savvy and might need more of the kind of traditional, let's take you to lunch and let's just chat about things and eventually we'll get to the topic of wanting money from you, and, you know,
right,
the more traditional fundraising.
And I wonder how much of that $12 million is going to go towards that sort of grassroots stuff, but we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what their next steps are.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Let's make a point of following this one and see how it develops, because I am curious to see if this is something that can be successful.
Yeah, me too. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yum, 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 yum.
There's other reform stuff, too, that I'll have to talk about next.
Okay. Well, and reform stuff, like, is reform going to be possible at the U.S. Patent Office?
Exactly.
There's been a lot of push, particularly among podcasters. And that's something that touches us a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the patent, a vaguely worded patent that could have dominion over podcasts, means that podcasters have to pay through the nose to some entity.
Right.
That's been part of the hullabaloo around the problem with patent law.
Right. And some of the other problems with patent law are that you now have patent trolls who sue companies over patents and, you know, end up getting a lot of money. There's a lot of time spent, a lot of public funds for court stuff. And so especially tech industry, again, is concerned with reform laws for patents, patent finance, especially to prevent the troll laws or the troll lawsuits and stuff like that.
And the way the trolling, and there's a whole This American Life about this, and we've covered it before on this show, but the way the patent trolls work is they buy up patents whose wording they could apply to a bunch of stuff, and then they'll contact you on letterhead, on legal-looking letterhead that says, oh, you're violating our patent, and you're going to have to pay through the nose. We're going to sue you. And many people say, well, it looks like I can spend this too much money or this even more too much money.
Mm-hmm.
So shoot. And they'll go ahead and give up a chunk of funds to the patent trolls.
Right.
And they're just the patent trolls aren't necessarily offended that their patent isn't being used well. They're just looking for money.
Exactly, yeah. And usually these patents that they buy up, they're not producing anything. It's nothing they created. They're a third party that's unaffiliated and just trying to make money.
Right. They're like collections agents, but worse.
Right.
Blech. All right. So that's the climate, and kind of exciting time because there is an opening at the top at the U.S. Patent Office. So some real chances at changing the direction of enforcement of patents and things like that.
Right. So the director seat has been open for 18 months.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And Michelle Lee has been filling in. and she is very pro-reform.
We like Michelle Lee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are some people that feel that their interests are not being represented by her because she's pro-reform. And so they've been putting a lot of pressure on the White House. So the Obama administration is also very, has said that they're pro-reform.
Right.
And so this came as a surprise to a lot of people, is that they're talking about appointing Phil Johnson as the next director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And Phil Johnson has been very openly anti-reform. Huh. He spoke out against the Innovation Act. He was a very vocal opponent of that last year. And that was a big step forward for stopping patent troll lawsuits.
Well, that is a confusing choice. If Obama is pro-patent reform, why? Where did this Phil Jackson come from?
Yeah, Phil Johnson.
Johnson.
He came from sort of a lawyer for pharma, like Johnson & Johnson, places like that,
okay.
Pfizer. You know, his background is very trenched in these
big
business.
He's represented big pharma before.
Right.
Okay.
And so they're thinking, you know, this is kind of my assumption too, and I don't know for sure if it's correct. Nobody's said exactly why they've chosen him yet.
Okay.
Is that...
Well, and there's what they'll say and there's what's really so.
Exactly.
We'll never know what's
the
truth. Okay.
Is that because Michelle Lee is so pro-reform that a lot of the industry that has a lot of money, pharma, feel that their interests are not being represented. And so this may be sort of a compromise so that someone is also representing their interests in the patent office, and that he and Michelle Lee will balance each other so that fairness comes out in the end.
Oh, because they're co-leading? Is it because they're colleagues?
No,
no,
he would be her boss. So I'm a little skeptical of that.
That doesn't seem quite, yeah. Okay. So it's a not, sorry, Big Pharma, if we offended you, here you can have the top position at the U.S. Patent Office.
Maybe, maybe not. Nobody's, you know, saying that that's the case, but, you know, I can't figure out why else they would have nominated him.
Ew.
But there's been a huge outpouring from tech industry complaining about this and concerned about this nomination. And so some of the Obama sites have been saying they're reconsidering. But I have a feeling he's going to end up in the position, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
So it's not a done deal yet, is what I'm hearing.
Right. It's a nomination.
It's a nomination. So then what are the next steps? Do you know that?
The
what
nomination?
Happens?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, because if he's nominated, then someone has to say, all right, second the nomination.
Right.
And is that Congress?
I think because it's a nominated position that it's just the Obama that gets to say who it is, but that he has people interested. And I'm not positive about that.
Okay.
But I'm pretty, you know, pretty
yeah,
sure.
Because I'd be interested to hear, you know, who are the influencers that people should lobby if they are not excited about the idea of Phil Johnson at the top.
Right. Well, call your Congress people.
Yeah. Well, we'll have a link to some information about it at our website, geekspeak.org, so you can learn up a little bit more and maybe do your own web research to find out if this is a subject that's of interest to you, dear listener, what you would like to do about it. Okay. Well, kind of a remarkable amount of political things happening in the world of tech. We'll talk about a couple of more when we come back. You're listening to Geek Speak. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, Andrew Nemer was practically born to tap. He started tap dancing when he was 3 and later studied with greats like Gregory Hines, Savion Glover, Jimmy Slide. Today, he's an acclaimed hoofer himself and a preserver of tap dance history. He retraces his own steps and those of his tap predecessors with KUSP's Robert Pauly on the next 7th Avenue Project. That's tomorrow at high noon on KUSP, or whenever you look for it at the talk section at KUSP.org. Speaking of KUSP, if you listen to KUSP through your local label cable TV system, we'd like to hear from you. By filling out an online form, you can help KUSP claim its share of copyright payments your cable system makes every year to the federal government. The online form will ask what town you live in, the name of your cable provider, how long you've listened over the cable, and which of our programs you enjoy. So thanks. It would help us out if you would click on the cable copyright link at KUSP.org, or you could leave us a message at 888-549-6421. That's 888-549-6421. And thanks if you can help with that. We'd appreciate it. Any, of course, as you know, we can put to use any dollar we get here. So any dollars that we get, we will nom nom. Okay. That was technical radio speak. We will om-nom-nom them.
Om-nom-nom.
Om-nom-nom. Om-nom-nom. Here's a thin segue. Om-nom-nom is something that Pac-Man used to do.
This is true.
An old video arcade. Yeah. Wow. So there was a discovery of a bunch of arcade games recently. What was that?
Yeah, a gamer on RetroCollect.com, you know, there are a bunch of retro gaming fanatics, reported that their relative invested in a Japanese building in Chiba, which is by Tokyo, and they discovered two floors of old arcade games. Two floors of the building.
Two floors? Yeah. How big was this building?
I'm not sure what the entire building was, but two floors of it were arcade games. Among the loot were 50 Sega Aero and Astro City cabinets, along with a handful of Namco machines. And within the cabinets were also original arcade game boards, including Street Fighter II, Champion Edition, Metal Slug X, Donkey Kong, Pengo, Magical Tetris Challenge, Galaxian, Raiden 2, and even Columns. The new owner decided that they're not going to reopen the arcade, and they're going to auction off all the games for the eager collectors. So everyone on the site was all a Twitter about it.
Yeah.
And they put up a photo gallery of the games. And
okay, so this is what makes this a geek bit.
Exactly.
Which is purely visual material on this radio show.
We'll put up a link on geekspeak.org, and you can go look at the gallery of the games. They call them candy cabs because it's just a cabinet that's generic, and you can put different boards in it to have it play different games.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. All right.
They're
so
Japanese.
You can take a look at those and, you know, do some wish listing.
Exactly.
All right. That'll be at geekspeak.org. Let's get back to the politics because there's plenty of stuff going on.
So much politics.
And this is something from a little while ago, what to do about NSA surveillance, and there was a recent sneaky maneuver.
Right. So the USA Freedom Act was kind of a big deal, and it passed in May, but it was gutted before it was passed. So a lot of the things that we wanted passed didn't go through. Mm. The bill was initially intended to reform the NSA, but in the final form, it still permitted the NSA to access vast trove of phone call metadata. So that was the big deal after the Snowden thing, is that we realized that they were looking at our phone records.
Yeah, wait a minute.
Yeah, and that was very disappointing to a lot of privacy advocates.
That they're still allowed to look at the metadata.
Right.
Yeah.
But in a late night session on June 19th, the House of Representatives voted 293 to 123 to pass an amendment to a Department of Defense appropriations bill that would cut off all funds for two of the NSA's activities that have been in hot debate since the Snowden leaks. Number one is performing searches of collected surveillance data that targets Americans. So that would be the phone records
thing. Right, right.
And then number two is asking hardware makers and software developers to build backdoors into their tools designed to give the agency access to user communications. So we also talked about that previously.
We have. There have been companies who have said, you know what, rather than do what you ask, I'm closing the company. I'm stopping the service.
Right.
Yeah. So that was a big one.
Yeah.
All right. So those two things were what happened with this bill?
Well, because the latest effort is an amendment to an appropriations bill and not a bill itself, it went to the floor without being scrutinized by the Intelligence Committee, which would have caused it most likely to be gutted like the USA Freedom Act was. But because they kind of snuck it through as an amendment, this message was sent by the House. They were able to make a statement by approving this. And they did it late at night.
They
approved the amendment to the appropriations bill.
Okay.
And the
amendment
the
says,
funding.
Basically, you're not going to get funding to look at Americans' metadata. You're not going to get funding to force organizations and companies to create backdoors for the NSA.
Since we didn't, were unable to get an actual bill to say you can't do these things.
Mm-hmm. They were just not going to fund those things.
We can't say you can't do it, but we're just not going to give you any funding for it.
Okay. So this is a little bit like the unfunded mandates when state government says, okay, counties, you have to do these things, but then they don't provide any funds for those things to happen. Those things don't happen.
Exactly. Well, there's more work ahead for, you know, privacy advocates. You know, it was a milestone that this happened, but we still have a lot to do. And so even if both the bill and the amendment had passed, it would affect surveillance efforts of NSA and CIA, but not the FBI. So they could still, you know, technically do some stuff where they let the FBI gather the information, then pass it along, you know, different things.
Oh, and those two organizations get along so well.
Right. So it would still be amusing to see how that would play out, but it's possible.
That'll be some good deep journalism later. We get to find out how those conversations went.
And just a side note of, you know, there's places like the Electronic Frontier Foundation that mm-hmm. do a lot of work, you know, pushing things like this amendment to the bill and supporting these kinds of efforts. And I found out recently that Amazon has smile.amazon.com. Mm-hmm. And if you use smile.amazon.com, they put a certain percentage of certain purchases towards the nonprofit of your choice.
Oh.
And so,
like truly your choice, or are you selecting
from?
They
have a list, but it's a very extensive list.
Okay.
And so I chose Electronic Frontier Foundation. So that's a way that you can help them do stuff if you shop on Amazon.
Okay.
And then Ben had pointed out to me that there's a plugin you can install in Chrome that makes sure that if you go to Amazon.com, it always redirects you to smile.amazon.com.
Oh, that's nice. All right.
And they have all kinds of different nonprofits you can choose from.
Are links that can let people know how to do that.
Yep.
Doable. All right. Let's put those up at the website after the show also.
You got it.
Okay. Fantastic. I wonder if public radio is one of the things you've been there also.
We'll have to get on the list.
Yeah, we'll have to get on the list. All right. Very good. All right. So that's what's going on with NSA surveillance. And now it's the Federal Trade Commission. T-Mobile. Overbilled consumers? What?
Yeah. So... have you heard of cramming?
Yeah, what is that?
So cramming is when carriers, like mobile phone carriers like T-Mobile, Verizon, and AT&T, there are little charges on your bill, and you're not quite sure what it's for.
Yeah, they always have a name, but you're like, okay, I don't know what that is.
Something generic. Yeah. You know, so they're unauthorized charges on your car, on your bill.
Oh, they are?
That aren't always specifically described. And this used to be a legal practice, and last year, all the major carriers were told to stop doing this.
Okay.
And recently, the FTC filed a complaint against T-Mobile saying that they had crammed bogus charges on consumers' phone bills, and they wanted to allow the consumers to get refunds for all of this stuff.
Mm.
So the details are that the FTC claims that T-Mobile received up to 40% of the usually $9.99 a month fee that is charged to consumers for subscriptions to premium SMS content, like flirting tips, horoscope information, celebrity gossip, things like that, that the consumer actually never signed up for.
Okay. So you didn't sign up for this, but you get it, and we're going to charge you for it.
Right.
Ew.
And the reason they can bill it on your bill as some $9.99 fee is because they're getting a cut for it. And so you're not getting billed through that third party that supplies the content. And that's where things get shady. And according to the FTC's complaint, T-Mobile in some cases continued to bill the customers for the services after becoming aware that the charges were fraudulent. So consumers were calling and saying, I don't know what this is, and they're either getting brushed off, or in some cases they issued refunds, and sometimes they only issued refunds for 2 months worth. And and they said that also the billing practices made it really hard for consumers to tell what it was that they were being billed for. It was just something generic, and then you had to kind of drill down into it, and then it still was something else generic.
Okay, so this is why it's in kind of gray territory for the Federal Trade Commission. Because it may have been something specific, but it wasn't described specifically, and it wasn't easy to find out what exactly it was.
Right. And T-Mobile's side of it is they say that these practices were industry standard up until, you know, the end of last year, and it wasn't just them. It was all the major carriers, and that they're being singled out.
We can't keep us all after school.
And then, right. And they're saying that, you know, they are much more pro, you know, consumer than the other carriers. And
at least we give refunds sometimes.
Right. Well, what they did a month before this filing is they sent out a notice that they were going to reach out to all of their customers that had these things on their bills and allow them to request a refund, which is something that the other carriers weren't doing. But the FTC is saying, well, that's relying on you to reach out to the customer instead of us making the customers aware and making sure that they get their full refunds.
Right, yeah.
So they've gone back and forth, and, you know. But that's the deal. If you've got T-Mobile and you had some weird charges or something like that, you can now request refunds.
Okay. And if you're not with T-Mobile, but there are some mysterious charges on your phone, you can't tell what they are, maybe it is, as T-Mobile says, that your carrier is doing it too.
Yeah, well, I think they all had to stop doing those things last year. But, you know, it's never bad to ask, what is this? What is this charge on my bill?
No relaxing, consumer. Yeah. Keep being vigilant at all things.
Exactly.
Oh, dear. Okay. So that's the world of cell phone technology. Now, what about digital currencies?
Well, there's all, you know, all the hullabaloo about Bitcoin, as you've heard recently. There's a new California law that repeals Section 107 of California's Corporations Code. And that had prohibited companies or individuals from issuing money other than U.S. dollars.
Now, this is something I didn't know was the case. And when I think of alternative currencies, before things like Bitcoin, it was things like Ithaca hours or those kind of trade dollars. Remember, that was kind of a thing, the trade economy.
Right.
The barter economy.
And not even that. It's things like your, you know, Mervyn's card, where you get points and you can use them to buy things.
Yeah.
So even though this was in place, they didn't enforce it.
Okay.
So it was against the law, but nobody...
No one knew, really, that it was against the law.
Nobody knew.
Frankly.
You know, technically everyone was, you know, breaking the law there and didn't really know it because
so anyone in California who had bought Bitcoin may have inadvertently been breaking the law, but now it kind of doesn't matter.
Right. Or had a Sears card or, you know, got points, gas points, you know, it was all on the same level.
Right.
So the original bill was actually intended as a consumer protection so that, let's say you did have, you know, a Mervyn's card and then Mervyn's went bankrupt and then you never were able to recoup the dollar amount of what they owed you, and then you file a complaint with the government and then there's lawsuits and, you know, so it was just intended as a consumer protection against stuff like that. And that's kind of why they didn't bother to enforce it on, you know, granular level.
Okay. What motivated them to release the ban? Is it just, you know, politicians' interest in getting at Bitcoin or what?
Right. They just want their Bitcoin to be legal.
Yeah.
It is kind of about that. They're saying that there's so many virtual currencies at this point that it's, you know, it's just silly to try and enforce all of that.
Yeah.
And so they want to get with the times, especially since Bitcoin's become such a big deal that they've actually, you know, written tax law, you know, about this.
Yeah.
And so now people can use the currencies other than the U.S. dollar without violating the law.
Okay.
And it's intended to accommodate the growing use of alternative payment methods like Amazon Coin, Starbucks Stars, and of course, Bitcoin.
And to get taxes from those.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Banks are still steering clear of Bitcoin, but there's signs of confidence in Bitcoin from private companies. Like Apple actually updated the App Store guidelines earlier this month to allow for applications handling quote-unquote, approved virtual currencies, as long as the apps comply with state and federal laws. Whereas before, if you had anything, you know, that handled Bitcoin, they wouldn't allow it in the App Store.
Right. Huh. Okay. So a little more freedom to pay for things.
Yeah, exactly.
A few more avenues. Well, as we proceed here with the stories of the day, you might want to weigh in on them also. Rick Filmon is in the other room waiting to take your calls with any questions or comments about the stories we're talking about today. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. That's 800-655-5877. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. Shall we talk about Amazon Fire TV?
Yeah, this was kind of an interesting
sort of a glitch.
One.
Yeah, what's going on there?
So a freelance writer was surprised when he was notified by his cable provider that he'd blown through his entire monthly download cap of 250 gigabytes in just a few days.
Mm-hmm. Now, can we, because I don't really have a sense of what's big and what's not big, how does that compare to like typical internet usage?
Well, I use my smartphone a lot.
Uh-huh.
I use it, except when I'm signed in on my Wi-Fi at home, I use it for browsing the internet, I send and receive email, I watch videos, I listen to music, and I have like a 1 gig cap.
Okay. 1 gig versus 250
and
gigs.
Sometimes I need to bump it up to 2, depending on how much I listen to Pandora in my car, you know?
Okay, so 250 gigs should be quite a bit. It should be plenty.
And some people that have that much are often doing HD streaming video because they have a cable box and they're not running on their Wi-Fi or something like that. They're using their cellular signal as their entire bandwidth, things like that.
Got it.
But 250 gigabytes is a lot. And to blow through that in just a few days, you know, that's pretty huge.
But, and was it just extremely exceptional quality pictures or what? What was this guy getting for that?
That's normally what you would think is that it's something with streaming media.
Yeah.
And he had just purchased the Amazon Fire TV and replaced his Roku box or moved the Roku box into a different room or something like that. Uh-huh. And he said that having the Fire TV, he unplugged it and put the Roku back and it tamed the bandwidth again. It went back to normal levels.
Okay, so presumably something about the Amazon Fire TV.
Right, and you know he's able to get HD movies and things like that, so he thought it was something. There's a feature on the Fire TV called ASAP where it does media caching. It kind of predicts what you're going to want to watch, mm-hmm. and it'll cache it so you don't have a lot of buffering when you go to watch things.
Oh,
and so he thought, oh, it must be this ASAP feature. Oh, wait, I can't turn it off. There's, you know, no ability to turn it off.
No.
So he contacted Amazon and let them know what was going on and, you know, create a support ticket, all that sort of stuff. And few days later, they got back to him and said, we did some troubleshooting, and it wasn't the media streaming or the caching. It's the screensaver.
What? The screensaver?
And a specific option on the screensaver that is not a standard out-of-the-box option. He had set it to the Mosaic feature, where it downloads little GIFs, little squares to make a picture look like a mosaic. And it wasn't caching those. It was downloading all those tiny images in real time to make the mosaics.
Oh, that seems like a very elaborate screensaver. I'm just going to say that.
And okay. Normally it would just cache that stuff and it wouldn't be downloading them real time. But
yeah.
They said they're going to fix the bug and they'll let him know. And, you know, okay. They helped him out. And they
so
were
it was some sort
compliant.
Of slip. It was a slip.
Yeah, it was okay. Just a bug in a first, you know, in the first release, you know, live QA. But if you've got the TV, you might not want to enable the Mosaic feature just yet on the screensaver.
Not just yet. Okay. So it's specific to people who are using that particular screensaver, this problem.
That setting for the screensaver
okay.
on the Apple TV.
Okay.
I'm right. Sorry, the Amazon Fire TV.
The Amazon Fire TV. Mm-hmm. Okay. A little blowback there.
Exactly.
All right. We know we got a call from Todd in Watsonville who wants to talk about bandwidth and home wireless. So let's talk to Todd. Hi, Todd. Are you there?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. So
how
what's,
y'all doing?
Oh, we're doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Great.
What's your question, Todd?
So here's my question. I live up on top of Mount Madonna. Uh-huh. Of course, we have no cable up here, and used to use DSL, which really sucked.
Yeah.
And so about a year ago, I went on eBay and purchased an unlimited data plan from Verizon, a grandfathered-in plan. So I then put a large Yagi antenna on my roof, and I'm now using 4G LTE for my home internet use. And that was great a year ago, but as you know, there's been a huge proliferation of 4G mm-hmm. LTE devices, particularly mm-hmm. The iPhone 5 and the 5S.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the day, my speed and the bandwidth that I get from the tower that I'm pointing at really gets drastically reduced.
As other people are using their devices.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I've been reading recently about a MIMO setup, M-I-M-O,
okay.
Which would require a second antenna. There's a SIM card in a small Verizon USB modem that is through a cradle point router, which is then attached to an ASUS router that uses 802.11ac.
Yeah, I'm getting a little acronym salad here. But what's the basic principle of the MIMO setup as you've heard about it or as you've understood it?
My understanding is that, okay, so my USB modem has two antenna ports. And so if I use both antenna ports and I set up the antennas in sort of an opposite configuration, that it will use the signal from both to give me more bandwidth and thus more speed and ability to use more devices at home. You guys familiar with this at all?
Well, it's one of the different forms of smart antenna technology where you use multiple antennas at both the transmitter and receiver to improve communication speeds because it can use either antenna depending on what's going on.
They can kind of team up and use compatible stuff to get
right.
More, okay.
Yeah, for transmission and receiving. But I personally have not tried that setup. Based on the different types of setups, that seems like it's a good one for what you're trying to do. What exactly... Are you asking if that's something that you should try, or were you asking something else?
I'm just asking if you guys have any familiarity or experience with that sort of setup and about just really about the practicalities.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're working with an ideal situation where you can choose between that and a number of other options. Right? Like the ideal situation where you just have good signal all day does not appear to be open to you unless you try something else. Like this.
That's correct. I mean, going wireless is my only really good option for internet accessibility.
And is it expensive getting a second antenna set up?
Well,
are you feeling caution because of some obstacles in getting it set up?
It's not inexpensive, and it's the antenna that I have on the roof, which is a large, long Yagi, the most powerful one I could find, with about 16 dBs of gain.
Mm-hmm. You paid for that.
What's that?
You paid for that, it sounds like.
Yeah, that wasn't inexpensive.
Yeah.
And some of the setups that I've seen are also, you know, similar setups are certainly not inexpensive options. But on the other hand, if it really is effective and then it really gives me much greater throughput and speed
then
it'll be definitely worthwhile.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the most popular ways to handle the kind of problem that you're tackling, according to what I've read about it. What we can do, if you send us an email to geeks@geekspeak.org, if anyone else is using this and can say one way or another whether or not this is something that would help in this situation, somebody that does have experience with actually trying this.
Listener poll.
Then send us an email and we can get some information all together and respond to you via email.
Okay.
Because I don't have personal experience with it, but I have heard that it works pretty well. But I don't want to say, yeah, it's great, and then have you go out and buy a bunch of stuff
and then
have
be
it not
disappointed
work.
And blame Lindsay Lonnie. All right, so two steps. Todd, send us an email so we have your contact information and remind us of why we have it. And then you out there who have tried out what it is Todd is considering. Thanks for your feedback about how that's going so we can pass that on to Todd. And it all happens by writing us at geeks@geekspeak.org.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Good luck, Todd.
Okay.
All right, cheers.
Bye-bye.
Interesting problem. And one that certainly happens quite a bit here on the Central Coast where there's pockets of no signal and, you know, various janky ways of trying to get good bandwidth.
Yeah, there's some good diagrams out there. Like, you know, there's CISO, CIMO, MISO, and MIMO.
Yeah. And what do they all
and
mean?
And MIMO is, you know, like a 2-to-2, whereas the other ones are usually a 2-to-1 ratio, whether it's 2 on the transmit and 1 on the receive, or, you know, 1 on the transmit and 2 on the receive. But
okay.
The MIMO is the multiple on both ends.
Right.
So it seems like it would be the most efficient way to do that.
Right.
But I just haven't tried it myself.
Right. And then there's always the cost-benefit analysis. How much faster is it?
How much
do you have to spend to get that much faster?
Right.
And how bearable is it now?
Yeah, we have enough people up in the mountains that have done things
we should
like
be able to get input.
Hopefully
yeah.
Somebody will have good feedback.
So thank you. If you do have some, please let us know at geeks@geekspeak.org. How about a quickie? Google buying Songza.
All righty. So Google acquired a music streaming service called Songza for the saying is around 15 million. And instead of using algorithms like Pandora and Spotify, where it matches the rhythm and the beats to things that you say you like and then, you know, find similar songs to play for you, it uses information about the user and the context to determine the best playlists at any given time. And all of those playlists are curated by music experts like DJs, Rolling Stone writers, things like that.
So we might have a career after public radio, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So Google Music already has playlists, but they're generic and static and don't have organization based around any specific item. But Songza lets you say what you're up to or what you're feeling, and then it provides pre-made playlists perfect for those situations, or so it says.
Perfect. Okay, perfect. Yeah, of course it's perfect.
Of course.
All right, so Google's getting into the game.
Yeah. After Apple acquired Beats, I think this is just kind of a one-for-one on stuff like that, trying to get in the game with Google Music. I'm assuming that they're going to integrate this with Google Music and have people, you know, have the constant play feature like they do with Pandora. People love that kind of thing.
Okay. All right. So we'll see more later about how Google integrates Songza into their growing borg of services.
Right. I like the Beats thing. They have like a Mad Lib style fill-in-the-blank where you put a sentence that cues up songs to fit your activity. Like, I like the fill in the blank. I'm feeling this. I'm doing that.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
But I just don't know how useful then. It will be. You know, we'll see.
Yeah.
I'll try it later.
Yeah. How easy is it to use, or how many steps do you have to go through to get to the part where you get to hear the music, for gosh sakes?
Right.
It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primshin, the host chair with Lindsay Lonnie, and we have a couple stories about science. The first is about the world's largest telescope on the make. It's in the making.
Yep. So on Thursday, June 19th, the European Southern Observatory blasted about 90 feet of height off the top of the Cerro Armazones mountain in Chile. That's almost a million tons of rock. They want to create a 655-foot pad for the future home of the new world's largest telescope, which would be the European Extremely Large Telescope, the EELT. Once it's completed in about 10 years from now and about $1.5 billion later, the EELT will be 200 feet high and 260 feet wide, with 798 small mirror tiles that make up the 129-foot primary mirror. It's estimated to be four times larger than the current largest telescope, which is the Very Large Telescope, the VLT. They're saying that the ELT will be able to collect light at about 15 times faster than any other telescope, and it will create images about 16 times sharper than even the Hubble. They say that this will allow us to peer into the dark ages of the universe, quote-unquote, like when the Milky Way was only 500,000 years old, and maybe see unseen galaxies, planets that could support life by detecting oxygen, all that fun stuff.
So seeing farther, longer ago.
Right. And the link I put up there has the video of the groundbreaking ceremony where they blow the top off the mountain. And but the video is from really far away, so the explosion's not super impressive.
Yeah.
But,
it's the reason, there's a reason we didn't put it in the geek bit section.
Right.
It's not all that visual, really.
Yeah. But if you do want to see it, just skip to the 1 hour mark in the video. It's right there.
You'll see a very exciting puff of smoke.
Right.
Boom.
Exactly.
So what's interesting is they're sort of altering the shape of the mountaintop to make room for this telescope. And of course, when I think of that, I think about, well, what about all of the mountaintop mining? That's a big scourge in Appalachia. There's sort of an interesting strain across the show today. Things that we're doing for reasons that we believe are good, which are the same methods that are used for things that we believe are bad.
Need to blow the top off the mountain.
But it's for science, though, so it's okay.
Right.
All right. And then also evidence that Earth's oceans came from within. What?
Yeah. Well, there's theories out there that the Earth's oceans came from comets that had ice and, you know, landed on the surface and gave us water eventually.
Oh, okay.
But there's a new theory that maybe the water actually came from within the Earth, and which would also explain why the volume of the oceans has pretty much stayed the same for all this time. So what they ended up finding was that a reservoir of water about three times the volume of all the oceans may reside deep beneath their surface.
Well, here we go.
Yeah.
I can imagine we're going to try and tap that later.
Well, what it is a rock, a blue rock called ringwoodite, and it lies about 700 kilometers underground in the Earth's mantle, and they found water in these rocks.
How did they get at the rocks to find water in them?
Some of them have come up through volcanoes and spouts, and that's how they found the rock itself, that it exists in
there. Okay, and that's also how they got the theory that perhaps water came from within, because it goes bloop up in volcanoes.
Well, the rock itself, when you apply heat and pressure, it sweats. It's like between the little grains of the rock, there's moisture. But you don't get to the moisture unless it's in heat and pressure.
Yeah.
So that's basically the ringwoodite story. And someone recently found a diamond that had ringwoodite attached to it that came up out of a volcano. And so they're thinking that that's the secondary evidence. But the way this team did it is they monitored 500 earthquakes and measured the speed that the waves came through the earth, including through the core. And when the waves go through water or anything with water liquidy, then the waves slowed down. So they determined that there was sort of a bunch of ringwoodite water with water in it in a certain section of the Earth's mantle.
Huh.
And they think that that could be quite a lot of water based on their studies.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, it must be massive, right? If the water is sort of sweating out between bits of ringwoodite.
Yeah, they're saying that they think the reservoir water within the rock is 3 times the volume of all the Earth's oceans. But
now we're getting to some interesting territory.
Science theories.
Well, my mind went directly to when we're thirsty, right? When there's I don't understand it, right? Because ocean levels are rising, wrong kind of water, not enough water on the central coast for us to drink and use.
Yeah.
So trying to use some ocean water. Eventually, you know, do we use up the water or does it just keep regenerating? The mind reels. But if we do need that ringwoodite water for some reason in the future, like providing water to the planets we escape to?
Well, my guess is that harvesting the water from that so deep within the earth and from the rock that it would just be too expensive.
It's like fracking.
It would be, it would be too expensive. And time-consuming to actually be practical as a water source. But what do I know? I mean, I'm no water expert.
Well, and I think if you're trying to get at it, then what balance of the center of the planet do you disrupt by trying to do that?
Do we end up a little raisin? You know, the inside's all sucked out.
Our wrinkly planet.
Yeah. I don't think that that's going to be a water source soon. But
yikers.
We have precipitation. We'll use that.
Hey, we had a question earlier, and there's parts of it that I don't really get, but I don't know if she's still online. It sounds like she might be. Let's see if Kelly in Aptos is there. Are you there, Kelly?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
So you had a question about Snowden about to release some information, and so I'm curious how you know about the information.
Yeah, released. You know, evidently a very small amount has been released. And it's going through these journalists before it gets to us.
Yeah, and there's lots more.
And so he evidently is an expert in all levels, according to himself, methods and operations and all this other stuff. And so what I'm wondering is the future release is going to introduce some kind of new technology like qubit computers or anything that we don't know about that's way ahead of the current technology that's been kind of black budgeted.
Oh, Kelly, we're getting to such conjecture territory there. Who knows?
That's the point. If we can guess ahead, a lot of times it's already been happened, you know? What I'm saying?
No, not really.
Well, when they put the qubit computers, they didn't think they were going to be used, and they were already being installed at the AT&T in San Francisco. You know, so there was technology that was supposedly not available was already in use.
So are you saying you're excited about trying to guess ahead of time what else might be in the information that Snowden hoovered up?
No, I'm wondering how much more of an edge it gives us, the surveillance on us. You know, I mean, maybe the surveillance is way more comprehensive than we even believe now, you know.
Yeah,
that's
maybe.
That's what I was pointing out to you.
Oh, I see. So
I mean, we're only finding out the old stuff that they're slowly telling us about, you know, like... You know, they don't care about telling us what they're doing now because they're already way ahead.
Well, yes. So it's possible that there is technology we don't know about and that we are being monitored more than we think. And there's a question of what about the day-to-day? How do you want to live your life? How much of your time do you want to spend worried about what might be so versus just getting on with things?
Yeah, I don't. What's your take on that, Lindsay? If I have to think about that stuff, it just stresses me out, and then my day-to-day life is low quality. You know, I do want to know what's happening because that's the only way to protect yourself. But there's certain things that there's no way I'm going to find out unless I go become a contractor at the NSA, you know, undercover or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And
we don't even know what the "I agree" button means. When we sign a contract to get on their websites, you know. So I'm just asking, you know, we're giving away a lot of rights. I just wondered how much we have left to give away. That's all.
All right. Well, it's an interesting point, Kelly. Nice spooky note to end the show on. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
All right. Cheers. Oh, goodness. Well, there is a bit of that, right? Like, how much can you protect yourself, really?
Yeah, we do the best we can with what we have is my take on that. You know,
yeah.
And I'm glad there are people out there who are willing to spend the time digging around. You know, then
yeah, for real.
We find out what's going on. I just know that that's not what I want for my life. You know, mm-hmm. Like to be worried all the time.
Yeah.
And it takes, you know, everyone to keep the machine running. And
well, I guess, and it's important to note that it is a choice. I mean, when we are saying I agree, there is several pages of material we could read before we hit that I agree button. That material is actually available.
Right.
And if we're not even doing that, mm-hmm. then does it really matter how much more is happening if we're not willing to put in the time ourselves to investigate it and decide to limit the options of technology that we use as a result?
Right. And, you know, things have gotten better with some restrictions and with some, you know, it used to be a bunch of legal jargon when you would go to sign stuff. In some places it still is. But there's been a lot of effort for them to make it human readable when you mm-hmm. agree to something mm-hmm. so that it's things that you can understand what you're agreeing to. And there have been a couple of times I read through something and it said they had the right to sell my information and I didn't agree.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it just depends.
Yeah, it depends entirely. So, yes.
Just a good note. The previously male-only Hearthstone competition, which is a software sporting competition, is now co-ed most of their stuff. They changed that from male-only to co-ed.
Oh, fantastic. So we'll find out more about that later because there's some implications about what does it mean to be part of a co-ed contest versus a single-gender contest. There's a fence that is available on both sides of that issue, I suppose. You have been listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. And to find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at GeekSpeak.org.